Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 10:07 a.m. and that is Taipei time. And this is the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes for August 9th. When we look at the total of bonds that have got negative yields in the world, the total has risen by $1.5 trillion in a week. That's a pretty extraordinary set of circumstances, and the pace with which bonds are moving into negative territory is extraordinary. It's also representative of a, on the one hand, a momentum move, and there is a panicky condition. People are willing to basically lend the German government money on any maturity and with the full expectation of getting a negative return. The entire Swiss yield curve is also negative and in even deeper negative territory. The quantity of bonds that is in negative territory is continuing to increase, but it's most particularly true of the Eurozone, Switzerland, and Japan. Now, what is the one thing that Europe and Japan have in common? It's a deflationary bias. And there is the additional prospect that the political uncertainty that has marred the outlook for investing in Europe for much of the last decade is going to intensify once more. We have now started to see that the Italian government bond yield is starting to pop on the upside once more. It was up 27 basis points in here today, it having contracted from 2.75% down to 1.5% in just the space of 10 weeks. It has now broken that downtrend. And we're starting to see some risk getting priced back in, particularly when we look at the fact that this looks like a rather large upside weekly key reversal on the yield. It confirms resistance here in terms of the price appreciation. It rather suggests that we're going to see a period of additional uncertainty. I think what's perhaps even more important is the fact that European banks are breaking down, and not by a little. They are breaking down in a dynamic manner. For the index to go from 90 in at the end of July to 60 today, that's a rather profound move in the space of 2 weeks. When we then think about that on a log scale chart, we can see very clearly just how much of a downtrend there has been. And it clearly highlights the fact that the index is now right back on the region of the 2016 lows. And this also corresponds with the lows put in back in 2012, but it exceeds the lows put in back in 2009. When we look at some of the worst performing banks, well, BPM in Italy was among the biggest decliners. And I may have the wrong ticker in here. And you can see that you just have to keep clicking to find some of the tickers for these. There have been such an enormous pace of mergers that have gone on. When we look at those decliners, sorry, it was Banco BPM was down 10% in here today. And that's obviously that's a response to the fact that Italy's government has just collapsed. It's going to throw further questions into the mix about the sustainability of the debt compact. But what I think more importantly is that it is probably going to start raising the question once more about the safety of deposits and the potential for bail-ins. What happens when some of these banks do in fact go bust? What happens to to the depositors of those banks? When we look at, for example, the chart for the Bank of Ireland, for example, It was at €6 as recently as April. It's trading at 3.33 today. When we look at the Irish stock market, it looks like it's got a Type 3 top developing, and that is following what had been a reasonably consistent trending environment between 2011 and 15. When we then think about what's going on in terms of Germany, this is probably one of the best charts I've seen. It's passenger car production on a 12-month summed basis, and the total in July was lower than the worst month back in 2009. Well, what this is clearly stating is that Germany's economy is at acute risk of a recession. There is obviously a problem in the European economy. When Ireland, for example, which is one of the most sensitive to the global economy, economies in the Eurozone area, it looks like that. Then we look at the DAX index, and it's right in the region of the trend mean. There is now the question whether this region is going to hold. It was looking earlier on this week that that region was going to hold. We had a nice pop on the upside yesterday and gave up much of that in here today. Germany is benefiting from capital inflows as a result of the questions that are being raised about the sustainability of the Eurozone project in places like Italy. One thing that we have seen on repeated occasions in Europe has been that every time you get a populist administration that comes to power, they make some big promises about what they're going to do and how they're going to stick it to the bureaucracy in Brussels. They see their government bond yields starting to spike higher, and then they lose heart, they get afraid, they do not follow through, they get eviscerated at the next election, and a new round of populists get voted in. Well, now the big question is who's going to win the next Italian election, and how long is it likely to persist for? The likelihood is that Germany is going to do whatever it takes to hold on to the euro, because it has benefited enormously from having the entire continent take its currency. And the euro has steadied over the course of the last 10 sessions. It has rebounded from the 110 area. It's now approximating the region of the trend mean. This is about where we can anticipate some resistance coming back in, because the last thing that Europe wants is a stronger currency. And they are likely to start cutting interest rates. And I think this is by far the most important point right now. When we look at the yield curve spread, it is now down to 9 basis points. Generally speaking, the yield curve contraction represents a reasonably bullish set of circumstances for the global stock market indices. It's usually not until we start to see the yield curve starting to steepen once more, following the provision of additional liquidity, that investors start to really price in that we are in fact going to have a recession. But one thing that I am rather cautious about at the moment is that if we are heading towards a recession, it has been the most widely forecast recession perhaps in market history. Everybody is so very keen to predict a recession now because they missed the last big one and they don't want to be caught short twice. I personally think that it is one thing to learn lessons in the market. It's quite another to learn when is the best time to deploy those lessons. And that's why I think when we think about the outlook for the stock market. It's really very important to consider that we have been ranging now for approximately 20 months. And so far, the region of the trend mean has represented support. We obviously had the very sharp drawdown at the end of last year and an equally sharp rebound. The market is now bouncing from the region of the trend mean. It continues to look like a reasonably bullish consolidation. And it is, I think, quite natural that we could anticipate some resistance in the region of the 3,000 level, just at least to unwind short-term overbought conditions. And there is, I think, the potential here that because everyone is worried about the next recession, that we are getting the monetary and fiscal responses early. I think that is something that is perhaps more important at the moment than the inverted yield curve. The yield curve has not yet been inverted, and usually between the inversion and the eventual peak in the stock market, you can get a really quite substantial run on the upside. And that could potentially coincide with a bubbly environment. I think that is potentially the base case at this stage. When we think about the quantity of outstanding debt, that there are massive unfunded liabilities, the ability of governments to continue to fund the quantity of outstanding debt is rather questionable, and they have a clear incentive to not just increase the quantity of debt, but to increase it to such an enormous extent that the size of the problem, in fact, creates the solution. That, I think, is the real potential here, that when we start to think about it in those terms, that when you owe a little money, it's your problem. When you owe a lot of money, it's the lender's problem. And that is exactly what we're seeing right now. When you look at, for example, the quantity of debt that's outstanding in the USA, then the massive unfunded liabilities, whether that is in Social Security or Medicare, whether it is among the states and the municipalities, whether it's in the pension funds, or indeed in the ability of the government to continue to fund itself, these are massive intransigent problems. And yet, what we continue to see is that the government bond yield is continuing to contract because people are willing to bet that all of these factors are going to represent a deflationary outcome. But what we definitely saw in here today was that we are starting to see at least some support starting to come back in terms of the yield around the 1.6% level. It is due some consolidation. This has been a very consistent and persistent downtrend over the course of the last 9 or 10 months. It's been characterized by ranges one below another, and we have just had a really quite impressive decline. We are due another range, and that range could last another 2 months before we see an additional leg on the downside. And that is assuming that this trend remains consistent. In order for it to not remain consistent, we would have to see the yield pushing back up into the overhead range. That would then start to look different. It would start to signal that people have had enough of this run up in yields. What I think is likely here is we are seeing people beginning to take positions and hedging their exposure as a result of the trade war. During a war, there is usually a massive run-up in debt, and it is usually then The economic growth that comes through from rebuilding and the pickup in trade helps to pay down the debt subsequently. When we think about what's going on in terms of China, well, they devalued their currency in here this week. It is now very clearly establishing itself at a rate lower than 7. It has been a rather long time since the renminbi traded weaker than 7, going all the way back to 2008. The reality is that China needs a weaker currency. Another one of their regional banks had to get quickly merged with a stronger one in here today. This is the third high-profile regional bank going bust just this year so far. The problem with monitoring this situation is that the quantity of or excuse me, the number of these banks that are in fact listed on a stock market is comparatively low. It is a market that is really quite opaque. There is a phenomenally large quantity of debt that is outstanding. What is, I think, particularly interesting is when we look at the size of the Chinese government bond market, it's comparatively small relative to the USA or Europe. The corporate bond market is still relatively contained. The corporate bonds are still a reasonably new asset class in China, and therefore it has not had the time yet to expand. But what we definitely have seen in the course of the last decade has been a massive run-up in the quantity of debt outstanding. Whether that is in the 500 billion that was written in US dollar loans over the period immediately after they tried to contract the shadow banking sector. That $500 billion in US dollar denominated debt, which was primarily issued by the regional banking sector, is obviously now at a greater risk this week than it was last week because of the devaluation of the currency. If the renminbi is devalued an additional 7 or 8% to compensate for the risk of additional tariffs being put on $300 billion worth of goods that were not subject to tariffs until the 1st of September, then that is going to represent an additional headwind. The major question for China is to try and contain capital flight. And anyone with any sense is getting their money out of China today, because there is a clear potential that the renminbi is going to have to be lower. It is nice political cover to say that they're devaluing the renminbi in lockstep with the size of the tariffs that are being imposed by the USA. But the reality is China needs a weaker currency. Their banking sector is in trouble. The regional banking sector is in trouble. The ability of the regional governments to fund themselves and their reliance on the property market and infrastructure development is something that is a really quite considerable issue. So far, China is running one of the largest fiscal stimuluses in the world, in the order of 4 to 5% of GDP. But that's being primarily focused at the consumer level. And it's an awfully big question whether China's consumer base is robust enough to make up for the risks that are outstanding in the manufacturing sector and in the infrastructure sector. Property prices in China are profoundly overvalued, and that's something that I think is not so much in the price. One question that I found particularly interesting this week was the robust defense of investing in China that Ray Dalio proposed in one of the interviews he's posted via LinkedIn. He's concluding that governance does not matter, and that the rise of China is inevitable, that it is going to become the preeminent global economy, because he believes that the problems on the debt front that are facing the USA are more profound than the debt problems that are facing China, and that gives China a relative advantage. And that's a very important calculation. It's that is something that we do need to pay attention to. There is, I think, an additional question that needs to be considered, and it's about the nature of capital markets. It's about the respect for minority shareholder interests. It's about the question about an independent judiciary and your ability to uphold your rights of ownership. Property rights don't exist in a authoritarian communist system. And there has been a massive move in terms of the quantity of cash that has been pumped into private equity ventures. It's certainly in China's interests to continue to think about private capital and to support its innovation in terms of. Certainly, China is well ahead in terms of fintech. The fact that the USA is still writing checks against a background where just about all financial transactions can be done securely via mobile phone in China is a very clear example of that. But one thing that we also know is that Alibaba, for example, has listed outside of China, and there have been substantial foreign ownership considerations in terms of where Alibaba has been able to raise capital. It's therefore in China's interests to ensure that the companies that do come to market remain private, that they source their capital from within the country, and that China retains ultimate control of their administration. And to the extent that foreign investors are going to be able to invest there, well, they're being allowed now to invest in the property markets and in the financial sector. But of course, all of the big growth has already occurred, and what China is in fact doing is it is diversifying its risk by selling off positions today in the financial sector and the insurance sector. They are effectively buying insurance. They're making sure that they're diversifying their own risk by spreading it out. This is effectively a reinsurance program. They are rather jealous of people investing in their domestic technology sectors. China has got a clear ambition to become the preeminent global economy. The question is whether they can reform and innovate quickly enough to ensure that that is in fact a potential outcome. Because what China really is risking today is at it's getting mired in a middle-income type of environment. The middle-income trap for China does represent an existential threat. Then we have the rise of populism in the West, and the massive quantities of debt. That is an additional potential issue. It is going to require a reimagination of the relationship of people to debt and the obligations that have been built up over time. What is likely, and in this regard, I do agree with Howard Marks, that it is likely that by now cutting interest rates and increasing the size of the Fed's balance sheet once more, adopting effectively QE4, and cutting interest rates, with Europe cutting interest rates into negative territory. We're in a rather silly situation right now in Denmark, where they are issuing 30-year mortgages at 0%, which is an incredible set of circumstances. If that doesn't create a property boom, I can't imagine what would. Well, what this is also suggesting is that investors are pricing in the potential that there is going to be a deflation, that once the stimulus from the fiscal stimulus as a result of the debt ceiling being increased last week, together with the monetary stimulus, together with the monetary stimulus from the ECB, with the potential for China to continue to expand its fiscal deficit and also engage in monetary accommodation to support its stock market and most particularly its infrastructure market, and with with Japan doing whatever it can to arrest the advance of the yen, well, that suggests that we are going to see synchronized periods of monetary and fiscal expansion. And that does have the potential to create bubbly activity. And when we think about the outlook for stock markets, well, I'm rather reminded of the kind of environment we had in the late 1990s, where we had the Russian debt default, the Asian financial crisis, long-term capital management, the peso crisis, all contributing to interest rates staying lower for longer. And that helped to inflate a bubble in the technology sector, or I guess most particularly in the technology, media, and telecommunications sectors. And right now, the US economy continues to grow. The banking sector in the USA has at least paused in the region of the lower side of its range and remains reasonably steady. It certainly isn't declining in the same way that Europe's is. Well, what this is, I think, highlighting here is that the epicenters of risk right now are in Europe and in China. There is potential for a blowback in the U.S. economy, but there's not a great deal of evidence just yet that that is in fact occurring. What we are seeing is that the smaller cap sector has been underperforming. It looks much more like the banks than it does the NASDAQ. We are also seeing that it's the export-led portion of the economy has been more volatile, but the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index is still trading above the previous peak in 2018. This does look like a first step above this range, or a consolidation above the previous peaks. So that does hold out the potential that we are going to get bubbly activity before a lot of the issues that people are really worried about do come back home to roost. But the very fact that we are getting what is effectively a competitive currency devaluation has been enormously bullish for gold. And the gold price is now pausing around the psychological $1,500 area. But this has been a very powerful breakout. And it's equally true of the rebound that we've seen in silver. And silver is now trading back above its trend mean. It has broken the more than 3-year sequence of lower rally highs. And this does suggest that we are back in a demand-dominated environment. And then the Bitcoin price has rebounded from the $9,000 level. And this continues to look like a bullish consolidation here. There is, I think, clear scope that we could be looking at an additional rebound in the Bitcoin price in the not so distant future. This is obviously representative of investors looking at the trend in currency devaluation and thinking that they need to take a hedge. Well, some people are just buying government bonds. That's one of the reasons why we have got negative yields. They are parking their money in these bonds for the simple reason that they are unsure of the security of their investments in other asset classes. Then we have the move in gold, which is a classic hedge against the devaluation of fiat currencies. Bitcoin is largely outside of the conventional monetary system and has got this limited supply argument. What's particularly interesting is that crude oil is trending downwards, and so far its rebound has been quite modest. The underperformance of the continuous commodity index, that also represents a slowdown in Chinese demand. The problem here is that I think it is the base case is that the US administration has reached the same conclusions that Ray Dalio has. They see the trend and they look at the advances that Germany put in the post-war period and were never really worried about Germany because it was an ally. And not to mention that the USA had military bases dotted all over Germany. It was never going to become a geopolitical adversary. Whereas China is definitely trying to become a geopolitical adversary. And it is looking increasingly likely that because the US administration has reached the same conclusion about China that Ray Dalio has, that they are doing today what they think needs to be done in order to ensure that China does not become the preeminent global economy. That they are it quite clearly trying to contain the risk. And that is putting, I think that is definitely putting us up for a potential competitive or resolution to these kinds of issues. China is not yet ready to compete militarily against the USA. And that is where the USA still has a clear advantage. They do appear willing to press that advantage. The fact that the USA is now the biggest energy producer in the world and a major exporter is also giving it the wherewithal to press its I think press its geopolitical advantage in the short term. What we've definitely seen is that China is also flexing its muscles internationally, but primarily with its checkbook, and investing, for example, $1 billion in Turkey over the course of the last month. And that is where we are seeing the changes coming through. China is becoming more aggressive in terms of buying loyalties, buying and investing in Europe, for example. Is obviously an attempt to curry favor with those governments. It does suggest that we are moving towards a more geopolitical uncertain environment. The downtrend in commodity prices suggests that demand is waning, and that is representative of the slowdown in economic activity in China and also in Europe. Europe continues to represent an area which is moribund in terms of economic potential. We had seen some uptick in interest in some of those peripheral markets. Greece, for example, has been trending higher over the course of the year so far, but even here we're starting to see some resistance coming through in the region of the peaks from 2018 and 2017. When we look at the long term, I think there is the clear potential that we are going to have a bubbly outcome, that subsequent to that there's going to be a recession, that the uptick in geopolitical tensions, and also that the questions about populism are then going to become more urgent. And that is also going to contribute to a more uncertain environment in asset prices. As long as stock markets are trading above their respective trend means, we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. That's one of the most important points, that monetary policy is the most important factor most of the time. And we are starting to see greater sources of additional liquidity hitting the market. That supports the bull market hypothesis. That supports Howard Marks' contention that by engaging in additional stimulus now, they're just going to make the problem worse later. And that's generally how politicians work. They would much prefer to have a massive problem so that they can say that the solution is necessary, and that there can't be any debate about what the solutions are going to be. And that does be appear to be the direction in which we are going, which is one of the reasons why government bond yields continue to contract. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.